Unfiltered opinions.
Sometimes you have ideas and you're not quite sure why.
You secure the bag.
Sometimes you meet people and realize there's probably a reason why you stayed in touch.
Just listen.
Sometimes all the pieces just come together by themselves.
Woo! I'm Jimmy Moyaha.
I'm Nicolette Mashile.
And I'm Simon Brown.
Welcome to Insider Exchange.
Welcome to another Insider Exchange. We're glad to have you back. And we kick things off right with Market Matters. We're looking at the markets feeling very unsettled this week. And we're looking at the reaction towards the Pick and Pay announcement. Let's start there. Because, wow, right? Straight into it. I mean, we're, what, 29, 30 rand a share on Pick and Pay? We haven't seen this level in forever. I think back to September of 2023 was probably the last time we saw this.
On the way down.
On the way down, not in this direction. And clearly the market loved the fact that the Boxer unbundling is going to happen. And it's not new, right? We knew about this.
We got all those details. So yesterday, Thursday, they published all the details around Boxer and margins, plus 5% operating margin as opposed to sub 2 for Pick and Pay, which is weird. So now you pull Boxer out. Pick and Pay is negative. Anyway, another story. Boxer looks really, really good. There was some, it was a fun slide pack. Of course, it is, you know, designed to get the Pick and Pay share price to 30 and the Boxer share price to who knows where. But for example, discount retailers like South Africa's got 6% and Poland's got 30. We are behind the curve in terms of that. Just bunches of really, really interesting and deep dive data, their growth plans, sites identified in development, in negotiation. Boxer looking really, really like a really good little business. Of course, it means Pick and Pay post Boxer exit is just Pick and Pay. And even when they get rid of all of their debt and everything, everything's nice, but it's still just Pick and Pay. But Boxer looks special.
There was, you said something, and I'm trying to pull it up now as you're going on about the discount retailers and the discount portion of the margin. There was something I saw on X where there's an analysis done of the market segments and where the growth is going to come from. And the growth is expected to come from the discount or the lower LSM segment in terms of groceries and retailers. And Pick and Pay feels underrepresented in that space, which I suppose without Boxer, they would really be. But you look at someone like a ShopRite that has a couple of components in there, right? Yes. So they've got the ShopRite, which kind of hits the middle LSM, but they've also got the USave, and they've got OK as well. So it's almost two different brands that operate the
and
same way.
And they've got their container stores.
And the container stores,
in some locations.
Which Pick and Pay tried in some township locations. It didn't work out. Do you remember that?
Yeah. I have to be honest, I don't know how well it's working with ShopRite. So here's the chart. Corin Richards posted it. So discount market share, Poland 30, Germany 27, Turkey 21, UK 13, Mexico 9, South Africa 6. I got to say, we're more Mexico than the others, right? Maybe we're a bit Turkish. But we've also got
maybe we're a bit Turkish.
But we've also, so they're saying, ah, look, we've got, you know, so much opportunity here. Not wrong, but also we've got a weird country. I mean, we've got spaza shops, which pick up a lot of slack. Now, I know if you've got a Boxer or a spaza, you're probably going to the to the Boxer. We've also got the, you know, the spatial planning, all that sort of nonsense that comes through. So, it was a really, in a sense of Boxer telling their story and giving you 3 years of KPIs. I mean, they've been growing at over 18% CAGR for 3 years, trading margin 5.5, you know, which is ShopRite levels. I mean, that's absolutely astounding. They're going to pay a 40% dividend or 40% of HEPS, but they put an asterisk to that because maybe they need to grow the business. cash flow conversion. I mean, just really, really good looking numbers. Now, let's be clear. This was designed, you know, to juice the story, but juice that it did.
It's working. I mean, and this is my question now is where we're sitting now at 29 Rand 50 to 30 Rand a share on Pick and Pay. How much of that is Boxer? Because as you said, without Boxer, there's negative growth on the Pick and Pay side of it. I think about transaction capital. When we stripped out We Buy Cars from transaction capital, we lost the 61% that it was of that business. How much are we going to lose on the pick and pay side of it when that unbundling
happens. All of it, right? Because Box is the profitable part. Pick and pay is not profitable. Now, pick and pay will become profitable because they will pay down debt galore, and that paying down debt is the rights issue for $4 billion.
Yes.
And then about a couple of billion from Boxer, and that gets their debt back to manageable levels. Mm-hmm. So now they manageable debt, but they've still got the operational challenge, which is why ShopRite ate their lunch and why they ended up in so much trouble. It's getting the stores attractive. It's getting shoppers out there thinking that Pick and Pay is the place to go as opposed to a ShopRite or a Checkers. That is the harder part. This is the easy win for Sean Summers.
Speaking of harder parts and trying to get things out there properly, markets, there's nowhere to hide. I'm looking at just the performance that we've seen throughout this week. Nothing makes sense. Absolutely nothing makes sense. We're in a high-risk environment. There's wars happening. Wars are escalating. That would ordinarily
Brent
speak
is $78.
Right? Middle East. Fine. Great. There's tension, right? Tension says we go to safe haven. Fine. Mm. The safe haven might have been the dollar. It's not the dollar because the dollar's not doing as well as you'd think because of the rate cuts. Fine. Let's go to gold. Gold's not moving either.
Well, I mean, gold's holding, okay.
It's yeah, gold's holding, eight. But yeah, it's not running as in
yeah, and we
people
did,
are afraid.
We've seen the dollar index a leaky bit sort of get some bid onto the dollar index. I mean, our rand was, what, 1704 on Monday? And
yeah, 1750-something.
Yeah. But so where are people hiding? China.
And that's crazy because we're in golden week. Chinese markets are closed, and before they closed, they were up, what, 8%?
So, Jen, Chinese markets are back at Jan 22 levels. They've basically raised 2.5 years of losses in 10 trading days. So where did everything go?
Do we still think the Chinese stimulus didn't go so well?
China, Hong Kong, same story. So Hong Kong's not quite as impressive. It's only back to Jan 23, mm-hmm. which is a year and a half instead of 2.5.
But the Nikkei in Tokyo has also been rallying quite a bit over the last couple of days.
Yeah. So where did all the money go? It went into Brent and it went into China, Hong Kong.
That's crazy.
It is crazy. Look, and I don't trade commodity. Well, I would be a shorter of Brent at 78. There was the Saudi oil minister who said all these cheating OPEC members are going to see oil at 50. And I'm like, yes, please. But here's the thing, right? You're, you know, Jimmy and Simon, super country, and we produce oil. And at $85, we're making money. Oil falls to 70. We're making 20% less. What do? We pump 20% more. Sorry, Mr. OPEC Plus minister. This is, and who's the biggest cheater? Russia.
Do you know what? And the other thing with the oil picture that's quite interesting is I remember when the oil price initially crashed down to negative on futures and all of that. We looked at, I think you and I had a conversation
over that
around
like
this.
It wasn't the most mind-bending thing ever. But anyway, carry on.
But we survived and we came out of it. But when it happened, I remember you and I were chatting about where to from here. And it was a very simple thing to say, it has to go back up. We can't not have oil. But a question that came up was, what is break even for the oil producing countries? And break even for them is probably below $10. So even if they cut down and the oil price goes to 50, it's not going to financially damage OPEC or financially damage.
Well, it depends who you are.
Within the OPEC block, I suppose, right? Some people might have a cheaper cost of production than others.
Yeah. And that's just it. So some have, you know, Saudi Arabia. That can't be right. It just popped up. It said 96. No, there's no chance that's right. the frackers break evens around the sort of 40 to 50 in the US. Of course, that's WTI, not Brent crude. But like, I don't know what Nigeria's break even is. Russia's not interested in what the break even is. They just want currency.
That's it. They
just want the currency coming through. So yeah, I mean, oil majors pursue projects and new projects coming on at like $30, but they're probably making money. But for many of these economies, Saudi Arabia, Nigeria, etc., oil is their economy. Hey? Mm. There's not much else happening.
Yeah, but if you think about the case of Saudi Arabia, they can afford to go down to $50 and squeeze the market if they need to, because at that point, your guys that cannot afford to be sustainable at that price start to fall away, and therefore you just gain more market share.
Yeah.
For as long as you're able to continue, and even if you say, okay, think about what happened in the pandemic, markets will go quiet, they will not buy up the oil, you just keep stockpiling the reserves because you're stockpiling at a cheap rate. At the point where the market does come back, it will, because companies like Boeing do continue to exist, you're just going to keep making money.
Yeah. And interestingly, I only learned this week, and I can't remember who told me, they stockpile oil down at Sudan sometimes. I did not know that.
Finished crude or?
Raw. Yeah.
From where?
Probably from the Gulf. Because the problem with the Cushing's is they're just running out of space. And so Cushing's used to be the American place. And then, of course, the frackers came. So it's shifted back to Houston to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, of course, it is physically settled. So when there's like really, really cheap oil, you've got to go and fetch it. So you just pop across the Atlantic, dump it in Saldana, leave it, price goes up, go fetch it, take it back. It's a weird way to do a trade, but I'm used to like click on a screen, but that's how real people trade.
That's how real people trade. Wow. That's crazy. That's absolutely nuts. Other developments around the world that we saw taking place this week, US numbers, right? We've kind of gotten over the whole jobs numbers and all of that, but Jay Powell came out from a US Fed perspective. Statement that said, I'm not going to be bullied into rate cuts. I'm going to do it at my own pace. We're not guaranteed to get another 50 basis points. And that's kind of what sparked the whole insanity or the chaos that we've seen in the markets this week was, on the one end, that we thought we were going to get rate cuts and consistent rate cuts. And he came out and said, hold your horses.
But is this not just him doing what central bankers need to do, which is A, try and keep the illusion of I'm in charge, not Mr. Market, and B, try and manage expectations? Because the market, I think, the market's been ahead of itself in rate cuts the whole year.
Mm.
But kind of trying to manage those expectations and say, you know, hang on a sec here. Yes, you got your 50, but there's no lock-in that you're going to get, you know.
Like another 50.
At November, we will sit down with, you know, clean sheet of paper and start from scratch and review.
That could be a thing. That could be a reality of
because,
why
central bankers have two very blunt instruments around inflation. One is interest rates, one is language. No.
I thought you were going to say the other speeches.
Well, yeah.
But speeches, that's what it is.
Yeah. And that's what they've got, which is really nothing.
Platinum and palladium pricing. Let's quickly touch on that because it's back above 1,000, seemingly holding above 1,000. Happy days for our PGM guys. I'm looking at some of the PGM guys, the likes of Northam, that have been on the receiving end of this.
Mm-hmm.
Now having a bolster of a week, a bolster of a day. Actually, just a really good month. I mean, looking at it now, it's up, almost 10% for the month.
Yeah. So it's quite – I spoke to the World Platinum Investment Council.
Mm.
Gent, we want these jobs. Do you know that they don't do the research? They
what?
Have a, there's a third party who does the research for World Gold Council, Silver Institute, and Platinum World Platinum Investment Council. So these guys basically just sit there and make PDF documents and take phone calls from people like you and I. That's a job.
Where do we apply?
Anywhere.
Anyone in our community that knows where we can apply for these great jobs, please let us know. We are in need of new jobs, and these clearly sound like what we want to do.
Yeah. So I mean, they're still talking platinum deficits driven by three things, cut in production. Mm-hmm. Mostly that's palladium, but still cut in production. Significant increase in China demand. So two reasons, gold price gone high. So Chinese investors are saying, let's buy some white metal. Costco is now selling platinum coins as well as gold coins. And Costco does 200 million a month in gold coins.
Costco sells everything, hey?
Well, also
if you're looking for something, you'll find it in Costco.
Not baby oil, apparently.
Not baby oil. Yeah, that's all at someone else's house.
So, and then so China, also the way the jewelry market works in China, there's no futures market, et cetera, et cetera. And then the shift of EVs from pure EV to hybrid.
Hybrid.
So they're talking about a 600,000-800,000 ounce deficit all the way through to 2028. But we had deficit last year, we have deficit this year, and the price ain't nowhere.
So where do we go from here? Do we hope for a rally on the stock? I mean, Chinese demand will continue to exist. China will figure out what, and the stimulus was very clear, was a very clear message to say, we are going to get things back on track.
Yeah.
We will deal with our other communist-related issues later.
It sounded like a 2008 statement, which was, we will do anything and worry about the rest later.
Yes.
Yes.
And the one thing that we've seen when China does something like that is they're not afraid to come out and let the currency run sideways, let it go wherever for the purposes of growth. And that's what's made them a big emerging market player in the past.
Yeah. So where to with PGMs? Platinum, palladium is stuck between whatever and 1,000, 1,100, platinum a little bit lower. And they're just range bound at the moment.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, so what do we need? We need vehicle sales, ICE vehicle sales. Although, fun fact, speaking to the platinum man again. So what they're doing is to help with range anxiety and stuff. You've got a battery, but then you've got a little motor. It doesn't run the drivetrain. It charges the battery. So Dodge is making one in America. They put a 3.6 liter engine in because, hey, they're American. You could run that off a lawnmower. No, they're putting a 3.6 liter. So we need, what do we need here? We need vehicle sales. And vehicle sales should start picking up. We had vehicle sales this week and they were 44,000, which is not bad for September. I mean, it's not knock it out the park, but it's not bad.
Who topped that list? Toyota.
Yeah.
Not the Germans. The Germans are suffering at the moment.
And who came third?
Mm.
Suzuki.
Yeah. The Germans are suffering. Yeah. Volkswagen was second.
And there's actually an article I was reading this morning just saying, you know, Motus has got all the high end and CMH has got all the low end and CMH is going to knock it out the park because he's got money to spend R1 million on a German car. Buy a little Suzuki for a couple hundred K.
That's a valid point.
Yeah.
That's a valid point. Well, that's Market Matters for this week. We move straight into our deep dive, and this week we're taking a look at grey listing and its impact on the investment space. The PIC put out their integrated annual report this week, and what I found most interesting was some of the comments from the CIO, Gabriel Rojozo, chief investment officer of the largest asset manager in the country.
3 trillion ZAR.
There we go. Mm. 3 trillion rand. It's not a small amount.
Mm.
It's probably very close to the GDPs of most countries in the African continent. And that's just assets under management that the PIC sits with.
Mm.
And the chief investment officer of this particular institution said that grey listing has had an impact on its offshore portfolio and on its ability to close offshore deals. Now, to be clear, only 15% of the PIC's capital is invested offshore. But 15% of around 3 trillion rand is north of 330 or 340 billion rand, right? So it's not a small amount. We'll do the exact calculation based on the exact number of assets in a moment. But the point is, if the largest asset manager is struggling to do these offshore things, what more the other asset managers in the space? And that got me thinking that the conversations we've been having about grey listing, great, it's all lovely, it's enhanced due diligence that now needs to be done, it's an added layer of security and all of that, but this is a material thing because most asset managers that have the 45% allocation, unlike the PIC's 15%, they rely on when the South African market isn't doing so well, which it hasn't been. It's only been running for the last 3 weeks, not the last 10 years. Offshore becomes almost your hedge against your local conditions, right?
100%.
So this materially impacts people's lives.
It absolutely does. And even to the small thing, Peter Bruce, I think he was tweeting it or maybe he wrote about it. He got a little NatWest account that got shut down. Because he's South African. Don't want to touch it. And what does Cora do with all those numbers? There's a couple of points to it. It makes life immensely difficult for the asset managers, big and small. It makes life difficult for you and I. But we can't buy an apartment in Florida. It wasn't going to anyway. But then I also can't help wondering, because what we're seeing, and I was chatting with Jason Swartz from Old Mutual around how everyone's buying our bonds, no one's buying our equities.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how much it's grey listing they're doing. Although you're buying the bonds, maybe that's not the thing. But I want to invest somewhere in another country. And let's be clear, we're an emerging market. We're not a frontier market, but we're an emerging market. There's a lot of us.
Mm.
And I'm running down the grey listed, just like flick. Just like don't even bother to look. Like,
that's it.
Why even put the effort? It's grey listed because you know what? Brazil isn't and this one isn't and that one isn't. Why even bother?
Mm.
So that's the impact on the incoming. And then you're trying to go out and you're like, hey, I'd like to buy your shares. Cool. Do fee.
Oh, South Africa. And they don't care that you're the PIC. And then we had, didn't we have the deputy finance minister? No, who was it this week saying it might take longer?
I'm not sure who that was, but I spoke to the guys at Business for SA. So the president seems to want us to do 3.3% in growth in 2025 and create 400,000 youth jobs next year or even the year after that. And we can do this and all of that stuff. And I had a conversation around that. And it was very critical to say that there are still some conditions. He neglected, of course, to mention those conditions. And those conditions are things we've spoken about. It's having constant electricity, having a reliable transport infrastructure in terms of logistics and transport in the form of Transnet, and having other conditions that are conducive to foreign direct investment.
Yeah.
Now, you bring up the point very clearly about the fact that inflows coming here, capital allocators sitting outside of SA, very easily have a list. Part of that checklist is, are you grey listed or not? If you are not, or if you are and your bonds are not of a certain standard or certain grading,
yeah, we are junk.
We cannot invest in them.
We junk status. We forget that.
Right. So it's all good and well to say we're going to get things done, get things back on the right track and all of that. But for the longest time, and this was a question I raised as well, was it's been all talk for a long time.
Yes.
Now, suddenly we have electricity and we want to be very optimistic that everything else is going to turn around. But on the other hand, I don't even know what to call it. The GNU, that's supposedly the glue holding all of this together, they themselves aren't being held together. And the reality is, aside from wanting to achieve these ambitious targets, grey listing has a material impact on investments. Now, let's be clear. That capital that asset managers manage is the capital that goes into your retirement fund, is the same capital that goes into infrastructure development and financing and all of those other things that you want to happen. When the private sector sits and says, private sector wants to put down this much money, it's the asset managers that manage that money, right?
Yeah.
Now, if those asset managers are not able to perform because we are grey listed, are we not understanding how serious this is?
I think we're not. And you know, there's another angle to it as well, is that, again, let's look at our bonds. Sure, foreigners are buying our bonds. Yes, our bonds have had a great couple of months, thank you, GNU. But we're grey listed. So again, there's a whole lot of potential bond buyers whose mandate is you can't buy junk.
You can't buy
grey. Just like it's not even on your list. Mm-hmm. So to the president's point, and I mean, I've been saying 3% next year is possible, but the big ones are the Transnets. The big ones are the grey listing. The interest rates and the inflation, those are nice and easy. Those are happening. The GNU holding together, well, we'll see in time. But those are the really, really big ones. And that's just for your equity and bond flows. Mm-hmm. If we want FDI, because those are processes, they're not impressed by 200 days of no load shedding. They're like, what do you mean? 200 days ago, someone turned your power off?
Mm.
They want 200 years of no load shedding type of scenario. Mm-hmm. So it in some senses, and I'm not saying that our bull market is fake, and I'm not saying we haven't got more upside to it, but we've got very excited about stuff that is a much slower process than we think. And let's be clear. Take interest rates. That is slow.
Mm-hmm.
Grey listing is magnitude slower. And getting off junk, man, that's...
That's a whole other thing. You have to prove... Getting off junk is not just adjusting your perception or adjusting your outlook. It's proving consistency.
Yeah.
It's proving that we are going to consistently be able to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Get your debt to GDP down.
Exactly. Now, yes... October is here. We are expecting midterm budget policy statement this month, and we'll do a build up to that. We'll get our thoughts around that in another segment or in another show. But on the grey listing matter, and when we look at just how to deal with all of this, I almost feel that what we just said about China being able to make the tough call, we need that.
Yeah.
I hate to say it, we need that. You need to be able to sit down, make the tough call and say, for the sake of getting things done and getting things on the right track, these are the tough decisions that need to happen. We don't have time to be going back and forth to court with high court appeals about this and that.
I think we've got one government official, of the important officials, no disrespect to most of them, and that's finance, who make the tough decisions. I don't think our president's very good at it. He's very good at consensus and negotiating, and he ran rings around the Capitol in the 80s when he was a unionist and everything. But there's a lack of making those really tough, really hard, really important decisions and saying, this is what how it will be, which is what China does, man. Some just like stamp, stamp. This is now the new lay of the land. You got choices, like it or leave.
Yeah, I think it comes back to a separate conversation you and I have had in the past around, for the longest time, we've been people-pleasing. Right?
Yeah.
And people pleasing of other nations. So we don't want to upset this particular country because we have diplomatic ties or relations or whatever it is. And you look at the approach that other countries take, right?
Yeah.
It's we're going to do what's good for our country. Botswana did it with De Beers and the gold and the diamond conversation. It was an unpopular decision, but they did it for their own benefit. They did it,
and that's actually a great point, because it's not that you have to be a nasty person or country to get ahead, but you can't get ahead and have everyone be your friend.
Precisely.
You've got to say,
you're going to make enemies along the way.
I remember, and we're going back 30 years now, when just post 94 and the ANC had been big friends with Taiwan. They'd been a big supporter of the ANC in exile. And South Africa as a country said, "Ah, no, China's our friend, sorry, Taiwan."
Mm-hmm.
And I was enraged, but it was a hard, you had to choose. And with respect to Taiwan, if your choice is Taiwan and chips or China, it's China. You need to make some of those very hard decisions. Mm-hmm. And they're not always popular. And it's not just making other countries happy. It's like he's trying to keep every CEO happy and every political party and every, it's like, but that is Cyril Ramaphosa, right? He is a consensus seeker in the sense that he wants everyone ultimately to be on the side. It's also the DNA of the ANC. I mean, the NEC is a unanimous organization. They want unanimity before they move on. They don't take a vote. Everyone must agree, which is lovely. When you're at, well, I was going to say at nursery school, it's probably even worse at nursery school. But it's just, it's not how you run a country.
Mm. And to be clear, we're not saying on matters like the war that's happening in the Middle East, the Russia-Ukraine invasion, all of those things, that we need to be picking sides and all of that. We're saying that in prioritizing the people of South Africa, the economy of South Africa, the strength of South Africa, put South Africa first. It's for this exact reason that, and this is probably another deep dive conversation, that we can't have the nationalization conversation just yet, because nobody is ready to make the difficult call. Nationalization is not a bad thing, but it calls for you to put national interest above self-interest, above political interest, above social interest, you know, those sorts of things. And it's probably why other conversations are difficult as well, around things like, what do we do with the social grants? How do we restart jobs? How do we do all of that? Because you need to be able to sit down, and I'm sorry to say this, but looking at the relationship, the government this week and the president's conversation was very big on how private and public sector collaboration has worked, right?
Mm.
And that's worked because the private sector runs on a set of rules. The private sector, a private company has a board, has a CEO, has deliverables, has all of those duties. Things, right? The public sector wants to appease everything. There's no structure in how we're turning around SOEs. You're continuously bailing them out, which makes the finance minister's job even harder. When something like grey listing happens, and that's what we're looking at here fundamentally, is when something like grey listing happens, a very concerted effort comes together.
Yes.
Mauritius, which got off the grey list in 18 months, was the quickest country to do it. Did it because they made the decisions that needed to be made.
Yeah.
You got put on the grey list. Okay, why are we on the grey list? There's 50-something things that need to be taken care of. We can't be having a meeting about saying, oh, but we've taken care of some of the things. Other things are still being passed. We're still discussing this. We're still doing that. And then every time Parliament meets, this doesn't come up. Parliament is meeting about things like the Judicial Services Commission, which has its own importance it. Nobody's taking that away. But we're dealing with grey listing that has a longer term impact on investment, on everything, on growth, on rebuilding. And all you need to do is sit down as a leadership committee, leadership being the leaders of the country, and say, these are the things we need to pass. Let's get the legislation passed. Yeah. Let's do this. Let's get it done. Let's push it through.
And this is notwithstanding our market. Okay, just off all-time highs. Imagine if we had got off the grey list in 18 months, because This is 18 months, yes. Right? It was February 22 and we got mm-hmm. flying onto grey list. Imagine if we had pulled finger and we were now getting the news that we were off.
Even instead, if we push it to 24 months and say we come off in Jan, markets would have started to anticipate that we've met all the conditions.
So I keep on hearing July or September, and then someone this week said, ooh, maybe it was our deputy president. Somebody said, like, it might not be so quick. And I'm like, what do you mean it might not be so quick?
I think
quick?
It might have been Deputy Finance Minister David Masondo. I'm not sure, though.
Yes, David Masondo. Mm, yes,
deputy
yes.
Finance Minister, who's also the chair of the PIC, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Yes. So the serious concern here is this is not a small thing. We make it out to be, oh, okay, cool. It has one or two implications on enhanced security and scrutiny in the international community. But as you said, Sai, rightly, some people aren't even looking at SA right now.
Yeah.
Because of this. Not even on the radar.
And we need to get back on. They might still not buy us, but we need to be on their radars.
I think the frustrating thing about it is understanding that it isn't just the one thing that it affects. It doesn't just affect KYC, which people, you know, it's a big impact on KYC, but it's not just that.
Yeah, it makes our lives harder, but it's so much more than just us, more paperwork. Mm.
And then you look at someone like a Moody's, a Fitch, an S&P, the ratings agencies that are all based in the US and unfortunately all are on the same page about how they rate the quality of our bonds. And when are we going to get off junk status there?
So they don't even talk around that, except there is talk of we need our own rating agency. That's not the answer.
Look, I'm inclined to agree with that. I'm inclined to agree with the fact that for as long as the US has all of the ratings agencies, it means the US controls the narrative on how everyone else's bonds are perceived. There's no neutrality.
Sure.
So I can see that argument for it. But if you're going to implement your own ratings agency, you need to have some uniformity. You need to have a consensus. And that's probably where you'd have that whole approach to say we need to sit and have a balanced scale. And China might not be the country to do that because they don't do balance very well. But neither does the US. So it's not you probably need a Switzerland to do it. But Switzerland's probably doing other things with everybody's money.
I was going to say France. Come on, baguettes and cheese.
Baguettes and cheese. Do we? France.
Yeah. I don't know. I like France.
I don't know. I think France has got internal issues that they've had to deal with.
Sure.
Which you've seen crop up, right? Yeah. And it leads me to wonder about their stability.
I was listening to a podcast this week around countries that did sort of hardline industrial policy. And we all know the South Korea story, and that France was one of them, and it hadn't occurred to me. But this was way back in the 60s and the like. Mm. And fun fact, in the 60s, the French gangs learned Russian so that when they got arrested, they could talk to each other and the cops didn't know what they were saying.
Do you know what? First of all, that's a crazy fact, but I think we need Ireland. If you think back, if Ireland. You think about all of history, right? If you think about all of history and you think about France, Germany, the allies, the wars, everything that's happened in the past, the Irish are good people.
Yeah.
They're simple people. They're honest people. They're not afraid to sugar. They won't sugarcoat the truth kind of thing, right? Yeah.
Ireland.
Maybe you put Ireland as the chair of this new ratings agency. But that's it. That's going to be another conversation, I suppose, that we'll have to look into, because there's so many things to unpack where we look at the impact that ratings agencies then have on bonds, intrinsically then have on how FDI sees that particular country. And I think about the SA situation as an example as well. Yeah, so people are buying South African bonds. But the governor, Lesetša Khanyago, Malume Lesetša said in the last MPC meeting that inflows into countries come in the form of government bonds. They don't come in the form of investment into stocks and those sorts of things. So you got to get government bonds protected. And again, maybe there's a very valid argument for why we shouldn't have all of the ratings agencies in the US, because it creates a bit of a bias.
Yeah. But I also think the whole rating, they made us junk. Mm. Why? Are we going to default on our debt? No, our debt seems are.
Default on our debt, what's... But here's the other thing about the double standards, right? So we're not allowed to default on our debt as an emerging market. But just, I think it was yesterday, I was doing something for the radio show. I do those interesting facts that I do on the radio show, and I still have it open here. In 2008, Yesterday, on October 3rd in 2008, President George W. Bush signed a bill that bailed out the U.S. financial system for $700 billion. On whose authority? Yet U.S. bonds are not rated junk.
Mm. Well, they did eventually in 2011 get dropped from AAA plus to AAA.
See, so by who? The ratings agencies that are based in the U.S. So there is a very valid argument to say you can't have such a concentration on the determinants of everybody else around the world. That kind of power can't sit in one country. It shouldn't.
Yeah.
But that's a conversation for another day. And this has been The Deep Dive. We wrap things up with Investor Insights this week. We're taking a look at FSPs and licensing. Clearly, the conversation that we had last week around the NCR and understanding illegal lenders sparked a lot of conversation on our community. And we appreciate that because it is that kind of feedback that allows us to keep giving you better content. So this week, we're going to be taking a look at the FSP side of things, understanding what FSP licenses look like so that when someone presents one to you, you know what you're dealing with. And then we're also going to be updating our wall, of course. We've got some great suggestions from James Gardenfingers Morris for some stock picks. We're going to be reviewing some of those picks, looking at how we make sense of them and where they rank on our wall. James, thanks as always for that. To the rest of the community that's still feeling shy, please engage. Send us the stuff. We want to look at them. Sometimes we don't really like some of the stocks that we find ourselves, and we'd love to hear what you guys are looking at. But let's get into it. Let's get into the FSP side of things. We're going to be looking at FSP licensing, and what we're going to do is I'm going to pull up the FSCA website and I'm going to pull up just the process of going through it, because I think it's also important to look at that. We often say, oh no, someone said they're licensed but they're not and all of that, and we said to people last week, just do your own research. It takes you five minutes, right?
Yeah.
Takes Don't 5 minutes.
Yeah.
You go into Google, you type FSCA, very simple. First thing that comes up is the FSCA's website with all of the verified ticks on the left. The fourth link there that says FSP search, you click on that, it takes you to the page that we sent out last week as part of our community. Now, on that page, very simple things. You've got two things that you need from any company that's a financial services provider that you intend to engage with. I say intend because I'm hoping everybody's doing this before you give the company your money. If you do it afterwards, it's a bit late. But anyway, you get here. You get to the site and pick an FSP. They'll give you either an FSP number or they will give you an FSP name. Let's start with the number. You enter the number in the top. If the number that you enter on top here is an invalid number, and I'm going to do that. I've entered an invalid number. We don't have FSP numbers that are six digits and above. You might have one that's five. You might have one that's four, or even one that's three digits. Those are really old businesses that have been around for a while, but they are still valid and they're probably the most trusted businesses.
Yeah, I just checked up. I found one that's 590.
Yeah, 590, but not six digits.
No. It's the three digit. It's like old business, 1996 registration.
There we go. I know some that are old as well. So if you look at the numbers, your first flag is if someone gives you an FSP number that's more than five digits long. So I've entered a random one. It's come up with a random FSP. Where it comes up with the FSP, there's a status that tells you whether it's authorized or not. Very simple, not complicated. So you'll either know if there's a license that's suspended, if there's a license that's under review, if there's a license application that hasn't yet gone through. There are some license applications where the application is still in process, hasn't gone through, and I'll try and see if I can find
one. Some that are lapsed.
Yes, there are some that are lapsed, absolutely. Where should we be? Let's see. 55412, I suppose. Okay, we're not at the 55s yet. Let's go perhaps 53. Right. There's one that matches that criteria, but there's no details about it. Right. See, that means that license probably hasn't been updated on the FSCA's website. They update this regularly. This is the place to look. And where it comes to licenses that have lapsed, the license number will still be valid, but because it's lapsed, it doesn't mean you can. It means you shouldn't transact with those people because that license is not an active license. You are not protected, and we'll get into the protection, but in a second, I want to pull up a license where individuals can see some of the subcategories, because that was something else we spoke about. Sai, was around people saying we're licensed and regulated, but not providing the right services.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm going to pull up a license that we know is authorized. And you go into the details section here once you've pulled up that license. And you go to the products that that license is approved for. And under that product category, you will see a list of things. For some companies, you'll see one or two subcategories. It is basically a list of the authorized services they're able to provide, right?
That is the, because that's the other thing, the one catches. Yeah, I'm allowed to sell long-term insurance, but actually I'm doing crypto trading.
Exactly.
Yeah, registered for one. FSP license doesn't mean that you can now go do everything. You are licensed for certain things.
Absolutely. And that's where the subcategories come in, right? That's the important part is, as you said, Sai, for some people, you can easily get licensed for one thing because your business was doing that.
Yeah.
But the moment you change into other things, it becomes a problem. The FSCA has had problems with this in the past where individuals have had licensing and said, I have these subcategories on my license. And the FSCA says, but yes, the type of business you're conducting means you are taking in deposits from clients. And let's be clear, when an institution takes in deposits from clients, whether it's for an insurance premium, whether it's for an investment or whatever, there needs to be a subcategory on your license that speaks to that. Yeah. You need to be authorized to take deposits. It is, that's how detailed our FSCA gets. And that's what I love about the licensing is all of the information is there. You just need to know where to look for it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it literally, I mean, I'm looking at a couple here. It gives you all of the process. It tells you exactly what the story is, what they can. These guys, these guys can sell you everything. Well, they're intermediaries, but the list goes all the way down. So now you know they're legit.
That's it.
Yeah.
And then when you go back, I've scrolled back to the top of the page. You've got a bit of a detailed section around the FSP number, the name of the company and everything. Easy thing for you to check. There's a registration number. That registration number must match a registration number for the exact same company name with the CIPC, which would now be BizPortal, I think, is now on BizPortal.
Yes.
So the business registry of the country, the CIPC, where all businesses are registered, FSPs have to be registered there as well. You have to be a business first before you can be an authorized business. So you have to go get your CIPC registration. That number, when you are authorized to have an FSP license, must match the registration number on this FSCA page. So very easy. Someone gives you a registration number for a company or a company name that looks different to what is being seen here and they don't have an explanation for that. There's another red flag for you.
Yeah.
Now, some companies change names. We're not saying that company names can't be changed in life. These things happen. Great, lovely, fantastic. But when that happens, make sure that the registration number matches the registration number on the website, because that's the one thing a company cannot change is its registration number. It is the equivalent of an ID number. It does not change. So there's something else you look at. The other thing you look at is the date authorized. Very simple, very self-explanatory. It tells you when these people started being approved to provide these financial services. Now, the date authorized is not really a red flag for me, because you can be authorized yesterday, you could have been authorized 200 years ago, as long as you're authorized,
right? I was going to say, the longer you've been around, the better. Not necessarily, but you could have been around forever and a day. I don't know when the FSCA started this process. I think it was in the 90s.
Late 90s, early 2000s was when they started this migration and having everybody here. The final thing I want to look at here is around the authorized individuals. Now,
yes.
You say yes like that. When we look at authorized individuals, a big thing around authorized individuals is understanding that if someone is selling you a financial product on behalf of a regulated institution, they need to be authorized by that institution to do so in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah. And you don't just somehow get there and say, please, sir, authorize me. Mm. There are exams to write. Mm-hmm. And then you spend a period of time sort of under supervision before you get to that thing. So that really is a process to try and make sure that there's quality there. Now, you might still get bad financial advice. That can happen. Mm-hmm. You know, absolutely. This is not a rock science thing. But it says that these folks are, they know what they're doing. Notwithstanding, we can all make mistakes and be wrong about markets and investments.
That's it. Now, on the authorized side of it, we bring it up because I saw something interesting. Actually, my radio producer told me about this. And there was a company in the US called Crumble Cookies, Cookie Crumble, something like that.
Yeah.
They've got a cookie business in the US. They sell cookies. A pair of Australian citizens, I say a pair because I think it was two of them, traveled to the US, bought a bunch of cookies, put them on a plane, flew them 17 hours or so back to Australia, and opened a pop-up store in the name of the US business. Now, they did this on social media. They did this online and everything. They effectively impersonated the store or this brand. And the end result of that was the very next... So they sold out of all the cookies. The cookies were tasting a bit stale, and they were marked up at a ridiculous price and all of that. And the very next day, the company then issued a statement saying, these people are not affiliated with us. These people do not represent us. They're not us. They've impersonated us. And now they're being sued for that, right? Yeah. Now, that's a cookie example. That's an, it's not even like a big thing, right? But financial services companies do that. And people do that all the time. The FSCA on their website, which I'm going to open up a separate tab for just to show people for that. The FSCA on their website has a section on the homepage. You scroll to the homepage. The middle of the homepage has a warnings and alerts section. Very clear. It says warnings and alerts there. You click on it and they've categorized the warnings and alerts by year for you. So you open up the 2024 warnings that they've given up and you'll see. I'll go through the list. So there we are. The second warning on that list is someone or individuals purporting to be an Old Mutual representative. This is the perfect example of what we're trying to illustrate here. Is Old Mutual has their own legitimate FSP license, which is 703, which you go validate on the site here. Very happy to do that. And someone is saying that they represent this license. And Old Mutual doesn't know who this said someone is. And the FSCA is warning the public against that.
Yeah.
So clearly people can take a legitimate license and still go and impersonate that license, which doesn't inspire confidence as a consumer to say someone can present me with a legitimate license and I won't be none the wiser about that, right? But this is where you come into the FSCA site and you go to the site and you see if you are able to find, this is Old Mutual Life Assurance Company, the FSP that we saw with that latest warning. This is the representative section. You simply press search. You can put someone's name in there, but even if you don't, simply press search. It brings up all of the authorized individuals according to Old Mutual that they have on their license. And you can see it categorizes them by surname alphabetically. So you can quite easily input
this person legit.
That's it. And that's the whole point is for institutions, especially bigger institutions like Old Mutual, they don't send people out into the market who are not authorized to represent them.
Yeah.
They simply don't.
They simply don't. And for the small fly-by-nights, so I see here Durban Forex Group has been warned against. The first question is, I remember with MiroTrader International, that Bitcoin scam, I kept on saying, where's your FFP? We don't need one. I'm like, you're dealing in money. You're taking deposits. You are doing automated trading. Yes, yes, and yes, you do. If you want money, then you must have license. Don't tell me that there's some lawyer who told you you don't. Your lawyer's a liar.
That's something else, because I remember for my entire kind of time in the financial space, I've always spoken out quite openly around the licensing side of it. And I remember speaking on a panel with the FSCA. The video is up on YouTube at a conference, the Finance Magnates South Africa 2023, and I did 2024 as well. Sai was there as well for, I think, this year. Was it last year? Either way.
One way.
I spoke very openly about how regulation is being seen by the regulator, and we had this conversation alongside the regulator. So a representative of the FSCA was there with us for this conversation. The whole point of this investor insight segment, today's one in particular, is because our community is growing and we love that. We absolutely appreciate every single one of you, but it's so important that everybody has the right information. And there's some information that I wish I knew when I started out in finance, and that's the information we're sharing. All of that information is stuff you need to know before you enter transactions. Because as I said, by the time the money goes through or the transaction happens, it's too late.
Yeah. And if the company says to you, we have applied and it's been processed, you say, cool, phone me when you've got the number.
There we go. Because processed does not guarantee it will be approved. Deal with approved and authorized services providers. That's what we're going to leave our investor insights on, but we're going to update our wall. We're going to get into some of our picks because we still need to get that done. And we are looking at pics that were sent through by James Morris. As I said, thanks, James, for sending that through. We really appreciate it. But today we're starting off with the international ones. We'll come back to the local ones in a second. And we are looking at DHL, and we're looking at Hermes. We briefly touched on Hermes. For those that are wondering, Hermes is the one that you spell Hermes, H-E-R-M-E-S. That it is the luxury brand that is based out of Europe. And we looked at that briefly with David Shapiro when we did luxury stocks a couple of weeks ago. That video is up on our channel as well. Go check that out. Hermes seemingly better than Burberry in terms of luxury. I mean, we looked at Burberry and Rolls-Royce last week, didn't we?
Yes.
So Hermes now in the luxury space, how do we feel about them? I know you don't like handbags.
I don't like handbags, but I do but I do like luxury. I do like luxury. I think there's a lot going for
it. A market for it, yeah.
Yeah, and I you know, when people tell me that you know, Mouchardon is luxury, I'm like, well, no. Like, you and I can afford that stuff.
You're saying we can't afford luxury?
No, if we can afford it, that is not luxury. It needs to be stuff beyond our price bracket. And I think that's where sort of the likes of Hermes fit into. I absolutely do. A lovely looking chart. Mm-hmm. It's a nice paying business. There's never much dividend yields from these sort of stocks, although they do at points in time. And I just, you know, particularly if you think that China is a big part of your luxury market. I mean, look what Richemont's been doing in recent little whiles. Mm-hmm. Then suddenly it's like, yeah, they're coming to the party. These stocks are just never cheap. I mean, like, you know.
No.
But they never are. They're like their handbags, right? It's the same sort of story. I mean, I'm looking. I mean, its 10-year mean PE is 48.
You should have bought Hermes in March of 2020 when the pandemic hit, because you could have gotten an Hermes share at 630 odd euros at that time in life. Today, that's 2,100 or 2,200 euros. It's done 400, almost 400%.
I must say, it's one of the better looking luxury charts.
Yeah.
It's kind of up there with Ferrari and the Richemont. I like luxury. The rich, the proper luxury. The rich can always afford it because they're so rich. China's going to be coming back on stream. You know, the US is doing perfectly fine. I like luxury, so why not some handbags?
And if you missed out on that 600 euro price point in March, June of 2022 would have given you another opportunity to get in around 975 odd euros. But again, March of this year, we peaked north of 2,300 euros. So you still would have doubled, almost tripled your money.
But they sell a belt. It is reversible, so it's kind of like, does that mean it's two belts?
Two belts in one. It means you can wear the one side, flip the buckle, and wear the other side.
That's good, because it's 11,000 rand.
Yeah, no, I better be able to wear both sides of that, and it must hold my pants up where it needs to. And wow, 11,000 rand for a belt.
Yeah, actually, that's their cheap belt.
You're not buying them for...
No.
No.
I mean, sandals are 20,000. This is my kind of... This is the silly sort of luxury.
Speaking of silly luxury, and we compared with LVMH, which is trading at around 660 odd euros as well, right? Christian Dior is also around that mark. Kering, which I know... I know Uncle David doesn't like, but the Kering Group for me is like an LVMH. It's quite versatile. It's got a couple of brands under it, and it's trading at 230 odd dollars, euros. So it is significantly cheaper than Hermes if you're looking at the stock. Is it cheap enough for us to have it as a replacement to Hermes? I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either.
Let's run through some of the brands that sit in the Kering Group, right? So they've got Gucci, they've got Saint Laurent. Mm-hmm. They've got Balenciaga. Mm-hmm. They've got McQueen, which I assume is Alexander McQueen. Yes, they've got Alexander McQueen. They've got Bottega Veneta. Now, this might not be the level of luxury that some people are accustomed to when compared to other luxury, but...
But this is a cheap stock on PE. It's got an almost 6% dividend yield.
There we go. Whereas the dividend yield on Hermes was 1.1% or something.
Something, 0.7 something. The PE here, forward PE is 14. The Hermes forward PE was 50.
They've got a diverse portfolio in that they've got jewelry, they've got clothing, they've got eyewear that they do as well. So I don't know. Do we... We like luxury. I've always been a proponent of luxury.
I've got to say, between the two, this is offering way better value.
Way better value. There we go. Maybe there's an alternative to Hermes. Let's take a look at DHL.
So I was interesting looking at FedEx a bunch last week. I didn't realize that DHL was Europe listed. Okay, learn something new every day.
That's it. Yeah. AG is German listed, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
Frankfurt.
Mm.
Which is the wild west of stock exchanges. the whole Steinhoff thing. Like, we would have, JC would have suspended them in a second. Because no results, right? Mm. Frankfurt's like, yeah, we don't care. Who needs results?
It's okay. You're a company. You exist. We believe you.
Yeah.
But I suppose the Germans are...
These DHLs, the FedEx and the like, very much they are a play on global growth. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's some nuances in it. Yes, oil prices, good and bad, etc. In the sort of sub-80s, oil is good for them. Sub-70s, very good for them. China story is going to play into through here. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we are doing so much more online shopping, these things need to get put into a truck. Now, Amazon has its own truck fleet. Sure. But we're not just using Amazon.
Mm. And I think what I like about DHL as compared to others, like I think about UPS and I think about someone like FedEx, they are predominantly or have predominantly been kind of US based.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas DHL now does, I sent documents to Dubai from South Africa via DHL. And
there's going to be a
day and a half. You drop it off at a postnet. A day and a half later, it's on the other side. It's done. It's sent. You can send it as a perfectly sealed thing. And it's convenient, right? So I kind of like DHL. I like that they're able to do what they say they're going to do.
Yeah, I like them. It's a hugely competitive space, but I like them as a business. I like them. This is not an expensive stock. Again, chunky dividend yield, 4.8.
Mm.
Yeah.
And invest in businesses you know and understand, right?
Yeah. That's the one's simple, right? Somehow they got your parcel from Postnet to Dubai. 36 hours.
I didn't care.
No, you don't care.
And I didn't care how much it cost them. It didn't cost me nearly as much as I thought it would.
Yeah.
That's it. We DHL. Like DHL. Cool.
We like it.
We like it. Local picks. Local picks have become quite interesting as well because they have been going through the most locally. Mm. Tungela.
Yo, cold.
I bring up Tungela because in recent times we've kind of been, when risk sentiment kind of kicked in and people were like, no, we're not going to do this. Tungela is one of the stocks that took quite a beating.
So here's a fun thing that I tweeted just recently. Mm. So coal demand is still rising.
It's
falling in North America, in Europe, in the rest of the world, Asia Pacific, which is China, which is Vietnam, which is all of those economies. I did a presentation to a local coal group about a year or so, maybe 2 years ago.
Mm.
There were like 75 coal power plants being built. These are 40-year lifetime
plants.
Now, this very week, interestingly, the UK shut down their last coal power plant. Mm-hmm. They no longer have coal. That's the UK. But Asia is still coal.
Look at the size of the UK. Yeah, literally on a map, geographically speaking. Compare it with the size of China.
And it's, everyone's like nuclear. Yes. Okay, nuclear. There's two problems with nuclear. They are immensely expensive to build.
Yes.
And as a planet, we have largely lost the expertise after the Chernobyl, Three Mile Island meltdowns. So nuclear projects that come on are over time, over budget, and utilities and governments are scared of.
And most nuclear scientists are Russian.
Also true. So I got to say, I'm not adverse to coal. It's still there. These coal miners are going to pay you great yields. The uplift in South Africa, of course, is at the same time that they're going to get some working better freight on Transnet and get that starting to happen. Eskom's running their fleet, so they're actually using, although the Eskom deals are usually cost plus, so it's no international pricing. But I think I prefer Exxaro because of the little bit of iron ore exposure.
Let's see what Exxaro's doing. Because I'm happy with Tungela's performance at the moment or their recovery.
Mm.
I think Exxaro, the last time you and I looked at Exxaro, you called Exxaro down to 160. Mm. The thing bounced all the way down to 150 and kind of came up from there. Now we're back at 165, looking at 160. I think there's an opportunity for us to realistically go back to 150 on Exxaro. I think they've got quite a bit of challenge coming their way.
The chart in Tungela is looking way, way better.
Yeah. So looking better and cheaper at from a share price perspective, it's at 117 Rand a share or so.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with Tungela. Are you going with Exxaro?
No, I'm happy with Tungela.
Happy with Tungela. All right. We like Tungela.
Yeah.
Interesting. And the other pick that we're going to be taking a look at from a local perspective, Coronation. Have we done Coronation before? No, I think we have.
I think we've discussed it.
Have we discussed it? I don't know if we've put it on the wall.
I don't think it's on the wall. Coronation, yes.
Okay. Bounced off of 40 Rand.
Almost a 10% dividend yield. Chart looking sweet and booming markets. Just if our market's up 10%, mm-hmm. their revenue's up 10%. And maybe it's up more because they get some performance.
And the cherry on top? They won that SARS case. That 700 million Rand that was going to be going towards SARS is going out as a special dividend. So Coronation for sure. Do we like it at 38 Rand a share? I kind of like it around 35, 34 Rand. I don't know if we'll get back to that because since we bounced out of the 30 Rand mark, we shot straight up to 40 Rand. Looks fantastic. I don't know if we'll be able to come back to 34, but maybe 35 Rand.
Yeah, it's one of those at current price.
Yeah.
PE 9.9, dividend yield 9.8.
And let's be very clear. I say 30 Rand and we're looking at historical pricing. At some point, actually not at some point, I'll tell you exactly which point. In 2015, the January 2015 highs, 115 Rand. So whether you get in at 36 Rand or 37 Rand or 38 Rand, if it's going back up in that direction, a Rand here or there is not going to make a difference to your life. No. Coronation, good stock to have.
Yeah.
That's also going to go on our wall. We're going to update the wall. There was something I did want to pull off the wall or at least move around on the wall because we got some developments from it. I'm just trying to pull up our wall so I can see where it was that we were looking at. We had it up. It was a local pick. I think it was Spa. We had Spa as a like it. They've exited the Polish business. They've given us some more announcements around the performance. The share price is currently at around 130 Rand or so a share. Do we still like it as much is my question.
No. I mean, we liked it a lot more sub 100.
Yes, 100%. Sub 100 was great.
Yeah.
Now we're at about 100. We touched 140. We're back at 130. I think we could potentially come back down to below 120-ish, maybe even close to 110.
Yeah.
I want to move Spa out of like it to kind of neutral because it's not free money yet. Yeah. I want to see if we... I think we must move that.
Yeah.
We're moving that. Met Air. They came out with
AutoZone.
Yeah, 290 mil deal on AutoZone. We didn't like MetAir the last time we spoke about MetAir, so they're definitely in our avoid section. Does that change how we feel about them? Still avoid.
Yeah, it's a whole different game for them. The market, obviously, seemingly, they're just sanguine, 0.25% higher. It's a fundamentally different game for them. They were OEMs. Mm-hmm. Now they're suddenly going into retail. Do people still work on their cars and do self-service on their cars to the degree that they used to?
Not if you can find a really good mechanic who knows what they're doing.
But where does that mechanic buy the part? Does he go to AutoZone?
Unlikely. Yeah. They probably have wholesalers. They probably go to a... they're like electricians.
To the OEME.
Yeah. They go straight there and they say, look, we're going to buy this here. It's cheaper for them to source and... Even if you think about repairing your car through your insurance provider, it goes through an authorized insurance repair house that doesn't necessarily buy through AutoZone. So Mete, we're leaving where it is. They need to do a little bit more to earn a higher spot on our wall or a different spot on our wall.
Cool.
That's it. Yeah, the rest of the wall looks okay. I think the rest of the wall is fine. If we update anything else, we'll discuss it next week. But that's been Investor Insights for this week. Remember, folks... If you've missed our conversations, you know where you can find them. We are everywhere. We thank our community oh so much for joining us in this journey. It's fun. We continue to do it. We love doing what we're doing. We have the most fun having these conversations and we do them for you. And if there's any particular conversation you want us to have, let us know. Until next time, investing isn't hard. Just try it.